Hi, my name is Anna Montague, and I'm excited to be here talking about my debut novel. How does that make you feel, Magda Eklund?
Magda Eklund is a psychiatrist living in New York City approaching her 70th birthday. Her best friend, Sarah, had planned a road trip for herself and Magda to celebrate the milestone. But before the trip can come to fruition, Sarah passes. To help get past her crippling grief, Magda takes the trip anyway. This is the plot of Anna Montague's debut novel, How Does That Make You Feel, Magda Eklund? I recently spoke with Montague about turning the tables on a psychiatrist who needs help. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Goulet, and here's my conversation with Anna Montague. So could you give our listeners a description of the book? That's kind of a loaded question, but maybe a brief description of, like, how did you sell it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a classic road trip story between two friends. It's just that one of them happens to be in an urn. It's the story of a Manhattan-based psychiatrist on the brink of turning 70, who's been deeply grieving the loss of her best friend, Sarah, in the years since she's passed, and discovers one of Sarah's journals, which included plans for a 70th birthday road trip between the two of them. And Sarah's widower, who's very quickly moved on, calls Magda and says, "Well, you know what? My new girlfriend doesn't want to look at the urn. Would you mind taking over that for the summer?" And so she winds up on this cross-country road trip with Sarah, though obviously in a different capacity than was originally intended.
You know, we learn the story through Magda's lens, and it's clear that, you know, she's working through something. And I couldn't decide if she, as a therapist, had neglected herself in the service of her patients, or if she had this, you know, stoicism inherited from her parents, or if she had been traumatized by something that happened in her youth, or all of the above. What should we know about Magda Eklund?
Well, she's a very good therapist. She's excellent at solving other people's problems. And at the outset of the book, she's exceptionally bad at looking at her own and acknowledging that her own problems exist.
You know, everything we learn about the characters in the book is through Magda's lens. And as a therapist, she's accustomed to sitting quietly and listening. And now the story is hers to tell. And since the book is set after Sarah's passing, we only get the view of their friendship through Magda's lens and through Magda's and others' memories and through the rereading of Sarah's letters. And this form of storytelling doesn't follow, you know, a straight timeline. Can you talk to me about your plotting process and how you decide on the time and method of revealing what we learn about these characters?
Absolutely. It was interesting. Over the course of writing the novel, three people with whom I was very close, two of my grandparents and a friend who was significantly older, all passed. And one of the things that kept running through my head is that grief is not linear. And a story about grief and grieving and the highs and lows of, you know, a decades-long friendship might not benefit from a conventional linear storyline. So I wanted to intersperse bits of Sarah such that you could really feel how alive she was in Magda's mind and the liveliness of her, of their friendship, really, how dynamic and bright and, you know, often unpredictable Sarah was when she was alive. But I thought that that was one of the particular challenges of writing someone who's so stoic in the way that Magda is. Much of the energy needs to come from the confluence of situations that she's up against, right? It's her memories, it's the present day, it's the actual journey, all of which in some ways are conspiring against the way that she has been viewing herself and living.
You know, you mentioned grief, and there were a couple of instances where Magda had to deal with grief, you know, in slightly different ways, because it was, you know, one death might have been expected and one might have been unexpected. And it got me thinking, you know, there was a point in the book where we learn about an argument that occurred between Magda and Theo, they're both therapists, about if people were inherently capable of true change. And then, you know, the stuff about Schrodinger's cat. And how much of this world of therapy and analysis did you already know about? And how much did you have to research in your writing?
That's a great question. I am fascinated by psychology. My grandfather was a science journalist and meteorologist. So, interestingly, a lot of our conversations were about death and dying from a pretty young age, whether it was Kubler-Ross or he was one of the first people to interview Kubler-Ross. And so I've been especially interested in the intersection of American psychology as it's pushing up against social progress, you know, specifically queerness and the way that queer folks are treated in America. You know, I did think that this timeline was especially interesting in the way that we got a quick tour of American psychology leading up to almost contemporary America.
You know, we mentioned earlier the letters that Sarah and Magda would write to each other. And Magda mentions several dozen that remain in her desk drawer because she felt the letters weren't good enough to send. And in the book, we see Magda as a late adopter of texting. This is a form of communication that she couldn't stew over. In fact, she wrote texts without punctuation, which made everything immediate and urgent. Can you talk to me about how this transition might have mirrored Magda's evolution and healing?
Well, I do think that so much about the digital age is finding ways to communicate more efficiently with other people, right? And the way that we communicate has changed so much since the outset of Magda and Sarah's friendship. And one of the things that I think because she's such a measured, careful person, letters give her a form of security because she gets to draft them, she gets to rewrite, she gets to reconsider before she sends. And there isn't that expectation of an immediate response when you're exchanging letters, whereas there's a different sort of urgency with texting. And I think in this case, I wanted that adoption of technology or attempted adoption of technology to show the bravery in embracing a different way of communicating, you know, something that would make her more visible, that would take away some of the calculated nature of how she'd previously felt comfortable communicating, even with the person dearest to her in the world.
You know, we don't hear the echo of the title. How does that make you feel, Magda Eklund, until chapter 53? And it doesn't come from the mouth of a therapist. Talk to me about the title and how it was chosen.
Well, I won't say more about when it's revealed. That would be a little bit of a spoiler. But, you know, originally the book had a different title, and the publishing team and I were talking about it, and it didn't really feel like that original title reflected the absurdity of some of the different characters, you know, the circumstances. And because it's a story where a therapist's teachings are turned upon her in some unruly and unexpected ways, we wanted the title to signify therapy from the outset and self-improvement. And in thinking through some of the most common phrases uttered by a therapist, which, you know, surely none of us want to hear, right? As someone who who's actively been in therapy for a long time, the very worst thing is your therapist asking you how you feel. Because you can't intellectualize, you can't keep going in roundabout tangents, right? You have to actually respond to the question itself.
Is it true that when you read a book, you read the acknowledgments first? Why is that?
I think the tenor of the acknowledgments is often quite different from the book itself. And I do love that opportunity to see the community that helped someone complete a book called out in that way, you know, and everyone has such a different approach to how they do it. But in terms of what influences them and what inspires gratitude, I've always found interesting.
I always skip the book jacket and any blurbs, but I do read the dedication and the epigraph first. So talk to me about your epigraph in this book. It's a quote. I think friendships are the result of certain needs that can be completely hidden from both people, sometimes hidden forever. And this is from The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith. What does this mean to you and by extension to the book?
Well, I will say that The Price of Salt was the inspiration behind the movie Carol, which I feel is one of the most impactful movies about female sexuality and societal repression. I mean, also because I, among, I've, but as my family and friends often tease me for, I have the world's biggest crush on Cate Blanchett. So, you know, that certainly factors in. But what I was thinking about in choosing that epigraph is the interiority of friendships and how often there are things that we think we're clearly communicating to others. And our friends are a mirror for us in many ways. You know, they'll see things we don't see ourselves. And yet some of the things that we think are readily apparent, if not obvious, are invisible to them. That quote feels like a reminder of the fact that you can't entirely know someone. You know, you can love them. In some ways, you can know them better than they know themselves, but they can't entirely be known by someone else, especially if they're not willing to know themselves to begin with.
This book is your first novel, but you're an editor at Day Street Books, which is an imprint of HarperCollins, and you acquire narrative nonfiction, science, and mission-driven wellness and lifestyle books. While you work in publishing, you work and write in different worlds. How do these worlds affect each other? How does your work as an editor, even though it's not in fiction, affect your writing in fiction?
Great question. I would say that the things I learn from both sharpen each other. And with narrative nonfiction, much of the work that I do is on books that are covering a big idea through the microcosm of personal experience. And, you know, in terms of establishing the narrative arc, the stakes, there are a lot of similarities between nonfiction and fiction. And in terms of drawing out characters and tension, there is a similar process. But I would say that on both fronts, my fascination has always been with people and their motivations. And those learnings can be applied differently to fiction and nonfiction, but certainly to both.
I'd like to talk a bit about the audiobook. It's narrated by Cynthia Nixon. Did you have any oversight in the production of the audiobook, or how does that work?
I didn't. The producer, Suzanne Mitchell, is phenomenal. And she's someone who reads the entire book and then comes up with a list of folks who she thinks would be great narrators. And Cynthia Nixon was the first person who came to mind. I thought that would be amazing. How do we make that happen? So in terms of oversight, no, I did go to the studio and I was able to listen to the recording, which was incredibly special. I mean, hearing someone that caliber of talent interpret your work is an incredible experience. And Suzanne did a phenomenal job directing and producing it. I will say both of them were probably furious with me by how many Swedish phrases were included in the book. So my oversight was limited to trying to offer pronunciation guides.
Has Magda stayed with you since you finished the book, or do you feel like her story is complete?
You know, I don't know that I'll write about her again. I think there are characters from this world who I'm not quite done engaging with, but I think Magda found her ending.
What do you hope readers will take away from this book?
One of the things that felt especially important to communicate with the book is that there is such vibrancy to older generations. I mean, one of my best friends is an 80-year-old. We met through a program that pairs queer seniors with young queer folks as a phone, you know, a weekly phone touch base. And I will say that that pursuit of adventure of creativity, of intellectual stimulation, all of that continues so long into life if you're open to it. I mean, my grandparents were 94 and 100 respectively when they died. And in their last years, they were creating art projects, right? They were making sculptures. My grandmother was taking on new sewing projects. And for me, the most important lesson from the book is that it isn't ever too late to start over or start trying to live your life on your own terms, but it's embracing the unpredictability of it that gives you the opportunity to really live fully.
Well, the book is How Does That Make You Feel, Magda Eklund. Anna Montague, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Anna Montague, author of the book How Does That Make You Feel, Magda Eklund, which was published by Echo. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Books and Whatnot is a podcast for readers, where we talk about the titles we've read lately and those bookish little discoveries along the way.
You know what, Beth? I have just realized what my favorite new genre is. And my favorite new genre is WTF.
It is.
Listen to Books and Whatnot every month from KMUW, part of the NPR Podcast Network.